So this one, the Greater Discourse to Malokyaputta, and following on from our Tadasa, the Shorter Discourse to Malokyaputta. Now, does anybody remember what was last week's one about?
Undeclared things
such as?
The ten questions.
And what did Malokyaputta do? He went on and on about the undeclared questions and wouldn't be satisfied with the answer, right? So, and at the end of it, it's a bit ambiguous, okay? So he just says, and the sutra just says, he's satisfied and delighted in the Buddha's words, which is a pretty conventional kind of ending, right? And so now, we'll find out the further adventures of Malokyaputta. Right. According to the ever industrious and almost always reliable Venerable Analia, the Greater Discourse to Malokyaputta presents an exposition by the Buddha on the five lower fetters. This discourse has a parallel in the Madhyama Agama, being of what school? Chinese. Did I hear somebody say Chinese?
Yes.
Is Chinese a school or is it a kind of takeaway food? Chinese is a language, not a school.
Then the other one I know is
Sarvastivad. Okay, well that's good. So you've got Sarvastivad, that's right.
The group of Sangha that are sufficiently separated from the rest in their own system.
That's very good. Thank you.
Actually,
you have a breakfast.
I read that
face
today.
All right. That's good. And a few parts of this discourse have moreover been discovered among the Sanskrit fragments found in Central Asia. And here's the details. Catalogue number 1279 in SHT, volume blah blah blah. Those fragments correspond to the introductory discussion with Malokyaputta. The Sanskrit fragments agree with the Madhyama Agama. So they agree with the Chinese translation in describing Malokyaputta's respectful behaviour by getting up from his seat before proposing his answer to the Buddha's question, a circumstance not mentioned in the Pali version. So what may we be reasonably allowed to infer from that particular happenstance, and what may we not be reasonably allowed to infer?
Chinese and Sanskrit ones probably more authentic than the Pali.
More authentic? Why is that?
More original.
Why is that?
Because there's two that agree and there's only one that disagrees.
There's two that agree and only one that disagrees. Does that mean they're more authentic?
Depends.
Depends, yeah. Sometimes the minority report is the more authentic. Yeah? Anyone have any other suggestions?
Why do the manners have so much meaning?
Depending on which school, which manners.
Yeah, well, sometimes there might be things that aren't particularly meaningful. It's not particularly important, but it's just an incidental textual detail. Sometimes it's just those incidental details that are the most interesting because they're the ones that nobody pays any attention to. So they're the ones that can catch people out. Yeah, but on the other hand, it can also mean. It could mean, for example, like a you have that passage where people come to see the Buddha, and some of them bow down respectfully and sit down to one. Some exchange greetings with them. Some just announce their name and clan, and some sit down silently. So each case, they're expressing a different kind of attitude towards the Buddha and the teaching. So you could see that redactors might use that as a means for showing their particular relationship with a particular context. So they might be expressing, for example, a greater or degree of devotion between a particular student and the Buddha, depending on their belief in or doctrinal relationship with what that particular student is saying. Yeah? Kind of thing. So it might have an effect, or it might not. So, but to answer, to put my hand up, answer my own question. What we are reasonably allowed or reasonably confident assuming is that in that respect that the Chinese and the Sanskrit are closer together, okay? And so if that's characteristic of the text as a whole, then those two likely come from a similar or closer textual family than the Pali, okay? More closely related textual family. And that's not unusual because, of course, Sanskrit comes from Central Asia, which is not far from China, so it's probably perhaps from also Sarvastivadin school or one of the related schools which is on their way to China. Okay, so we can't conclude, and what we're not able to conclude really is very much more than that, because obviously we don't have enough evidence to be able to make up our minds, but at least to be able to think that's consistent with a view that the Sanskrit fragment is possibly Sarvastivadin. Can I briefly say what Sarvastivada is? Right.
Briefly in an English dictionary.
Yeah. Because I'm sure you mentioned it before. But you can we're asking.
Simple answer is.
How to win friends and influence people.
Simple answer is that an early Buddhist school, which no longer exists, not in the text.
You're spoiling everything for Bhante.
No, it's good. Okay. They are an early Buddhist school. So in the history of Buddhism, we have what we call the 18 schools. Who knows what all 18 schools are?
Mula Sarvastivada, Sarvastivada, Mahasangika, Mahasashika,
This is just funny, it's got a tape in here. Okay, here's the 26th. Which is here. So the school's my school. Okay, so in Buddhism, as we know, they had schisms, and Buddhism split up into different schools. And traditionally, the ancient sources typically speak of 18 early schools. Okay? Now, the 18 schools are both too little and too many.
Good.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
It means that some of them are schools and some of them are just...
kind of...
So some of them there were no schisms between different philosophies or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I know that. I've heard it in your talk this morning.
Did you what?
I've heard it in your talk this morning.
Oh, right. Talking about it. That's good. Yeah, I'm just using it because it's a nice table, but it doesn't seem to be one. Okay, so yeah, that's fair enough. That's right. So that there were... If we count up all the names, if you count up all the names of all the schools everywhere, you get a lot more than 18. You get maybe 30 or 40, right? On the other hand, there is probably only maybe even 7 or 8 or 9 really serious schools, and the rest of them were basically local variations. Some of them might have just been one monastery, which has a name, and we think of it as a school. And there really are 4 big groups of schools, okay, which are probably represented here in this list here. So the first subgrouping, here we have Staviravada and Mahasangika. Okay, Staviravada being the Sanskrit spelling of Theravada. Okay, this particular list, as I often struggle with as well, is a bit ambiguous because here we have the Staviravada in Sanskrit. Here we have Theravada in Pali for some We're using Vajrayana in Pali, Pugalavada in Sanskrit, and so on. So it's not entirely consistent, but it's hard to get it that way. So this is the first initial grouping. It's Theravada and Mahasanghika. Now this Theravada is not identical with this Theravada, which is us lot, right? So the Theravada we know today. The Theravada today, which is the Sri Lankan school, is one of the sub-branches of the original school we call Staviras. So I would prefer to call them Staviras, just to make it
distinguish,
yeah. So there's two main branches. Now under those main branches, you then have the Mahasanghikas then broke into a number of sub-schools. Okay, so these are all sub-schools. And these are just one monastery, basically. Upara Shaila and Uttara Shaila is basically the northern and the southern cliff in a place called Andhra. So it's as if we've got our monastery here, and on the other side over there, there's another monastery, and we're called this side of the cliff, and they're called that side of the cliff, and that's two schools. Okay. So they're the Mahasanghika branches, and the Staviravada branches, there are three main groups under the Staviravada. Okay. Three main groups of schools. One we call the Pudgalavada, which is that's wrong. Patsy Putris, these guys should be under there. These guys actually belong under there. Mm-hmm. I will. It's Wikipedia, I might have to do that. Yeah, we won't get into it right now, but well, that's tempting, I must admit. But these guys are actually sub-schools of the Pugalavadins. So you have three main groups of schools, each of which has its own sub-schools. And again, the sub-schools largely were maybe regional variations that then differentiated over time. Three schools. Pugalavada believed in what?
Person.
They believed in the person. Which means?
Means there's some kind of person who exists in matter. Matter, part of the five aggregates, not separated from the five aggregates.
Right. And what does that prove?
They're not Buddhists.
They're not Buddhists?
They believe in a person, a soul?
They still believe in non-self, but they have some weird kind of conception of what a Buddha is. Personally.
See, it's interesting that you should say that, because in a sense they were defined in opposition with the school that we know of as Theravada, okay? And the main Theravada treatise, Katavattu, starts out with a long refutation of the Pugala, okay? And so this is why we're so certain. See, we still inherit this bias of our school that, oh, if they're teaching, they're talking about a person, they must be non-Buddhist. Whereas what they asserted was that they were teaching the correct understanding of not-self. Yeah?
What differentiates the different schools is not the text of the Buddha, that they all rely on the suttas, just their interpretation of what the Buddha said, that's what differentiates the school from a different
school. Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so they all do the Vinaya and
exactly, yeah.
Sutta.
Yeah, yeah. And those would be a little bit different, but not significantly different. But they would have Abhidhammas and later treaties, which were quite significantly different.
And do they all practice?
I would hope so. Well, these guys, Pugalavadins, were supposed to be one of the main Vinaya schools in ancient India. They were actually the biggest school in India. When Xuan Zang went through India about 7th century or so, Pugalavadins were the biggest school of Buddhism in India. Okay, now they've entirely disappeared, except we've got kind of 3.5 treaties of theirs in Chinese translation, and that's all that exists. Yeah. So Pugalavada, Vibhajyavada, the doctrine of analysis. And that's broken up into the Theravada, who I would call the Mahavihara Vasins, which is the dwellers in the great monastery. Okay, so the word in the Theravada scriptures themselves, when the Theravadins refer to themselves, they usually refer to themselves as the dwellers in the great monastery, which means there's a big monastery in Sri Lanka, Anuradhapura, that's where they dwell, right? And so that's a very good title because it's very specific. You can actually go to the place and you stand on it and you say, when you say Mahaviharavasins, you mean the monks who used to live here. Yeah, so it's very clear. Whereas Theravada is very ambiguous, especially historically. Mahishasika was another group related. They were possibly in the Mahisa region. Kashyapiya probably descended from a group that went to the Himalayas. Dharmaguptaka were descendants probably of Yonaka Dharma Rakita or Dharmagupta, who went to Gandhara and then later on that school went to China. And these guys were the sub-schools of the Pugalavadins. Okay? And what was Vibhajavada distinguished by?
The doctrine of analysis.
Distinguished by distinguishing.
Distinguished by distinguishing.
Which means?
A distinguished thing.
What do they distinguish?
This from that.
Yes? What do they distinguish?
Dhammas?
Dhammas?
They distinguish the past, present, and future.
No.
Ah, pretty good, Bart. Mm-hmm. Is that on another talk this morning? No. No, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good answer. Often they're described as distinguishing precisely that, the past, present, and future. Yeah? It's not sure really what it meant, what that word meant originally. It doesn't seem to mean that when it's used in the Pali, but often that's how it's meant. And in saying that they distinguish between the past, present, and the future, they are meant to specifically contrast with what school? Tick, 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 tick. Okay, here you go. Savasivada. And you get 3 points. Okay?
Because the
Savasivadins believe in. No clever answers, okay?
Are we quiet on this one?
Not even dumb ones. They believe in. Time's running out. Sarvasivadins believe in?
Buddha.
And? And? They believe in Tuesdays, yes. And? What do they believe in that makes them Sarvasivadins?
They believe in.
But I know you know the answer, okay. Everyone else is going to get lazy.
What does the word Sarvastivada mean?
That's a good thought. What does Sarvastivada mean?
Sarva.
Everything exists. The doctrine, the Vada, that all, Sarva, Asti, all exists. Okay? Right. In Chinese, it's. So, what does that mean? Everything exists. Huh? What does it mean? Everything exists.
In the mind.
Everything exists in the mind. No. Everything exists
in, but no emptiness.
No emptiness. Actually, they talk a lot about emptiness.
In the emptiness.
Sorry?
Survive.
It's all one, man. They believe it's all one. It's kind of like that a bit, yeah. All exists in the past, present, and future.
All dhammas exist in the past, present, and future.
Is another school Buddha held to the existence of all dhammas in the past, present, and future, and the three times the Abhidharma Kosha. He who affirms the existence of the dhammas in the three time periods is held to be a Sarvastivadin.
So what's the difference between them and the ones that distinguish past, present, and future?
And they say that not that the present, typically, the Vibhajavadins say, the present exists, and the past and the future do not exist. Okay? But they may have a more subtle formulation than that. For example, sometimes they say, past dhammas don't exist, with the exception of past karma which has not yet yielded its fruit. Okay? Or some other such subtlety, okay? But typically they say the past and the present exists and the past and the future don't exist. Okay?
David?
Yeah?
Are there any arahats in any of these schools? So I know that the first tradition is correct because you have Aryans and arahats. So the teachers are correct because they were. But in those other schools,
yeah.
Are there any arahats? Do they work? Or is it just intellectualizing you?
Well, look, I couldn't really say.
Even though they're all wrong and we're right, because, you know.
I mean, that's what the Theravada school would have us believe. Personally, my feeling is, and this is only a feeling, is that in any of those schools, then somebody who is very spiritual. See, I don't think that membership of a school means that you come along and sign on the dotted line and say, I believe all the things that this school tells me to believe. And I think that just as within the Theravada school, if you look at the people who are regarded as arahants or highly spiritually attained, they don't necessarily actually subscribe to all the views that are supposed to be Theravada, okay? By no means. Sorry?
Or deny others.
Yeah.
Other.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially in the first tradition.
Yeah. So they may or may not agree with various perspectives of their school. So it's very important to remember this, that when we speak of a school, we don't mean a monolithic block of people who all believe the same things. Yeah. And, even within the Theravada today, there's a wide disparity of different views and so on and so forth. So my feeling is that the most important thing would be the people's relationship to those views. And that was a perspective which was actually articulated by a number of the old schools as well. So that if you look in a lot of the texts, like, for example, the Shariputra Paripricha, that actually says things along those lines, and so it will praise each of the schools for having its particular emphasis and its particular good qualities in practicing without feeling the need to sort of define itself by saying we're the only good one and all the rest of them are rubbish. Yeah? So this is kind of what I reckon. Okay? So Sarvasivada, Mula Sarvasivada and Sautrantika. Mula Sarvasivada means the root Sarvasivadins. Probably, I'm not sure what it says here. And Sautrantikas means those
sutras only.
So those who rely on the sutras, the rejection of the.
Even though they called the Sautrantikas, they still relied on other things, though, is that correct?
They still developed their own Abhidhamma. They didn't completely reject the Abhidhamma, but they just said that the Abhidhamma was not the highest authority. So there was a more of a kind of an independent inquiry school. Often it's felt that so some of the theories that were utilized by the Yogacara, and so it was often felt that they were kind of a bridge between the Sarvasivadins and the Yogacara, although whether that's a product of later scholastic reasoning or not is hard to say. Also known as Darshtantika. Right, there you go. So that's the Sarvasivadins. So the Sarvasivadins flourished from probably shortly after the time of Ashoka, mainly in the northwest of Buddhism, well, northwest of India, and until the end of Buddhism in India. And today they exist in the many of the early Buddhist texts in Chinese translation stem from the Sarvasivadin school, as do similar texts in the Tibetans, and also a lot of the manuscript finds are also Sarvastivadin. So there's a lot of their textual corpuses around. In fact, we have most of their Diga, their Majjhima, the Sanyutta, a lot of their verses, their Vinaya, most or all of their Abhidhamma, and a lot of their later treatises as well. So we have actually maybe 80 or 90% of their whole textual corpus of the Sarvasivadins, and that's the only other school apart from the Theravada that we have such a broad spectrum of texts. So this is again one of the reasons why they're so important. Okay. Danny? Any more questions, Danny?
Should another sheet?
Okay.
We all have to learn these things.
Yep. Oh, thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sarvati. Sarvati, of course, being Sarvasti, and Sarvati sounds similar, as in Sarvastivada. And so the commentary says it's called Sarvati because Sarvanati, it's got everything. It's a market town that's got everything, so they're called Sarvati. This is commentary. That's not what it really means. Anyway. A bit like Bandanon, yeah. There he addresses the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied, the Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, do you remember the five lower fetters as taught by me? So, who here remembers the five lower fetters? Eva.
I've
got it. Personality, view, doubt, a thing to rules and observance, sensual desire, here. Right. I'm just amazed that anyone. I'm not going to say anything, but I'm just amazed that, given the, how the sutta went on from there, that anyone would actually answer that particular thing. Anyway, that's right. Because the Buddha, of course, gives the Manukiputra a good dressing down for giving his answer. And what are the five upper fetters? If they're the lower ones. What are the five higher fetters?
Ignorance.
Yeah.
Vitikicca.
Vitikicca is a higher fetter.
Conceit
is one.
Agitation.
Udraksha. Yeah.
Elsewhere.
That's three. Conceit.
Rupa raga.
Yeah. So attachment to rupa. It means attached. Basically means attachment to the four jhanas. Okay. Rupa raga. Arupa jaga raga. Attachment to formless attainments. Okay. Uddhacha is restlessness. So that probably means, what Uddhacha means in that context is that you're a bit too kind of eager to get enlightened, and so you don't let your mind rest enough. So you think of that, it's almost like that's, those ones are almost the pair of each other. Rupa Raga, Arupa Raga is a bit too erring on the side of Samatha. Uddhacha is erring on the side of Vipassana. You sort of too keep on punching away, and you don't need to bring your mind to stillness. No. That's already in the lower ones. Rupa raga, arupa raga, uddhacca, restlessness, conceit, which is thinking I am, the thought I am, and ignorance. You already had it. That was the first one.
Ignorance.
Avijja. Eva.
Is conceit not the same as personality view?
No.
No.
Why?
Why?
Why is it not
Why? Do you have personality view in your translation? I've got identity view here. This must be a later translation.
What's the real translation?
Identity. Identity is good, yeah. Or embodiment. Yeah, no, all these ones. Embodiment was pretty good.
That's the idea what they call Dasa Samyojana.
Dasa Samyojana, exactly, yes. Yeah, I should have the name. Yes, the Dasa Samyojana and Panchoram Bhagyani Samyojanani. Conceit, mana, is not a view. Sakkaya Ditti, identity view, means having the view that oneself is one of the the five khandhas or one of the five khandhas. So I am my body, for example, or I am my mind, or I am my feelings, or something like that. And mana is not the view that you're part of your body, not the view that you are identical with one of the five khandhas, but it's a kind of like a floating around impression of an I-ness that's left behind when you take the view away.
It's the Atman.
But is it like just habit? Like they know that there is no self, I heard that somewhere.
It's more. I mean, it's more subtle than that. But yeah, it's not dissimilar. Like somebody who maybe wants to give up smoking, and they know that it's bad, and they know that smoking is wrong, and all of these kinds of things, but they just can't help it. Mm-hmm. So this is against like a habit of thought. You know that there's no me, but you just fall into the habit of thought. Yeah? So it's that's not.
What's the distinction? The high and low. Why is it?
Okay, the low ones, the three first ones.
Is it stringent to get through that?
Three first ones, Sakaya Ditti, identity view. Vichikicca is doubt. And Sila Bhatta Paramasa is misapprehension of virtue and vows. These three are eradicated by the stream enterer. Okay. Karma Chanda, sensual desire. And Vyapada. Ill will are lessened by the once returner and eradicated by the non returner. Okay? So it's a teaching which tells you in a stage by stage way the different stages of enlightenment and which particular defilements they get rid of. And the five higher fetters are only got rid of by the arahant. Alrighty? Okay? Now,
what are the seven?
Sakaya Ditti.
Yeah, well, there are seven, are there? Or
seven kinds of Sakaya Ditti.
Yeah, there are seven in Sakaya Ditti. Are there seven?
Yeah.
Not the Anusaya.
How's it go?
So it's seven Anusayas.
I'm the same, I'm equal to, I'm different, I'm higher, I'm lower.
I'm not sure exactly.
Yeah.
You know that one?
Yeah,
I'm
sure
equal
that.
To. I'm better
yeah,
than. I'm
less than. That's conceit, yeah. Not sure about
that
one, Chandra. Yeah. Seven. You might be thinking of the seven anusaya, seven underlying tendencies, which is similar to the fetters. Similar list. Okay. Right. Venerable sir. Okay. Identity view, doubt, adherence to rules and observances, ill will, sensual desire and ill will. And the Buddha replies, Malankyaputta, to whom do you remember my having taught these five lower fetters in that way? Right? That's a somewhat surprising response by the Buddha, because he did teach it that way in many places. So it's a little bit weird, I think. And according to the commentary, the explanation to that is that Malankyaputta held the view that a person is fettered by the defilements only at times when they assail him, while at other times he is not fettered by them. The Buddha spoke as he did to show the error in this view. Okay, and we'll understand what that means in a moment. Just to come back to the Chinese version. Okay, is exactly the same so far? Okay. Would not the wanderers of other sects confute you with the simile of the infant? Okay, so here the reference to the wanderers of other sects, of course, reminding us that Malankyaputta, previously was caught up in those kinds of views. For a young, tender infant lying prone. Okay, so here is the Kumara Samandasa Uttana Seyakasa. So,
my little baby lying in the cot.
So, Ukumara Manda Utana Seyaka. Now you know how to say that in Pali. Isn't that cute? Ukumara Manda Utana Seyaka. Don't say you never learn anything useful in Pali. Okay.
But the truth is about to be revealed.
Sakayo Nahoti. Okay, so he doesn't think. Nahoti, Sakayo, it's mine. Okay, he doesn't consciously identify. Okay, Sakayoti pi nahoti. Kutokanasa upajisati upajisati sakayaditi. So where from where then would arise the view of an identity? Okay, so the, even the thought identity doesn't occur to him. Okay. Kidoki. So how could identity view? Yet the underlying tendency to identity view lies within him. Anu se ti dueva sa sakai di tanusayo. So this is this idea of anusaya I just mentioned a minute ago. Anu, along, saya, lying along. So notice this is actually the same word here as utana seya kasa. Don't worry about why it's the same exactly, but this is the same root. Seya is actually lying prone. So it's literally underlying, or in, perhaps you might translate it as inherent or underlying. Yeah. So the underlying views, the underlying tendency, often translated to Sakaya Ditti, is underlying them. Okay? So what that means is that even though the defilement is not actually arisen in that moment in his mind, then the potential for it is there. A tendency, I think, is a little bit too weak in that context, because tendency is like, you know, when you open up the newspaper, you have a tendency to read the sports section first or something like that. It's a tendency, whereas we're not talking about that kind of tendency. What you're saying is that when the conditions are right, that this will happen, this will reoccur to him. Yeah. So perhaps I tried using compulsion in one trying to translate as compulsion.
Was that the translation you just used just before? Not tendencies, he used another word.
Inherent. I don't know. Hard law fetters. Underlying tendency. Not sure. Don't think it could be inherent something. Okie dokie. So the young tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion teachings. Dhamma. So how could he have doubt about dhammas? Okay, so here Bhikkhu Bodhi chose to translate dhammas as teachings.
Dhammas meaning things or dhammas as in teachings?
Well, you could translate it either way. Okay, and he doesn't, lying prone, he doesn't even have the notion sila, conduct. So how can he have sila bhata, attachment to sila? He doesn't even have the idea, sensual desire, so how can he have the sensual desire? And a young tender infant does not even have the idea beings. Okay? Sattva, so how could he have ill will towards beings? Okay? This is not the only place where this simile is given. There's a few other places where similar ones are given. So here, of course, pointing to... Does that mean that Buddhism has an idea of original sin? Even the little baby lying in the cot is really full of evil intentions and so on. It's just waiting
to lash out.
To grow up, sorry?
Yeah?
Yeah? Are babies originally pure?
No, they're not when they're toddlers.
Especially not when they're toddlers. Mums are shaking their heads. So...
No, they inherit the karma that they were born.
Yeah, they've all got those tendencies and stuff in the past, yeah? And their nature as organic beings, yeah? And so their nature as organic beings, they have to eat and so on, so they've got all these kind of instincts and so on programmed into them. Right. So... Thereupon, the Venerable Ananda said, "It is the time, Blessed One, it is the time, Sublime One, for the Blessed One to teach the five lower fetters. Having heard it from the Blessed One, the bhikkhus will remember it." Okay. Kalo etasa sugata bhagava, kalo etasa sugata kalo. It is the time. Okay.
So he remembers that at the end of the class.
Here, Ananda, you get yourself in trouble asking this question. An untaught ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined, unskilled being a kovida, undisciplined avinita, okay, same root as vinaya, this is vinita, okay, has no regard for true men, the sapurisa, means the Aryans, and is unskilled and undisciplined in their dhamma, identifies with a mind obsessed and enslaved by identity view. Right? And this is pariyukita. Pariyukita. Obsessed. Itti. Pareta. Enslaved. And does not know the escape, the nisarana, from arisen identity view. And similarly with doubt, rules and observances, attachment and lust, ill will, does not understand it actually is the escape from these things. When that ill will it has become habitual and that is uneradicated in him, it is a lower feta. Okay? Tamagato. When it becomes habitual, tamagato, when it has become strong. Okay? And a well-known, well-taught, a noble disciple is, of course, just the exact opposite. He knows the escape from these things, he's not obsessed with them, and so on. And identity view, together with the underlying tendency to identity view, is abandoned within him. And according to the commentary, the fetter and the underlying tendency are in principle not distinct things, rather it is the same defilement that is called a fetter, in the sense of binding, and an underlying tendency in the sense of being unabandoned. Okay. So notice that this conception of the underlying tendency, of course, is philosophically problematic, yeah? Because we can understand, well, yes, you have a tendency for these things to appear, but in what sense do those tendencies exist? Right? When they're not actually there. Yeah, so this is where people like Sarvastivadins appear from, yeah? Because they start to think about these things a little bit too much, perhaps, right? And they start to think, well, there must be some sense in which they exist, even though it hasn't arisen at that stage, so in what sense do they exist, okay? Yeah? And so this is where that kind of discussion, where, things like Sarvastivadins, when you first hear, you know, all dhammas, past, present, and future exist, then it sounds weird. But then when you start to realize, well, actually, there are genuine philosophical issues which they were addressing. And they themselves had many different interpretations on this. They were a very sophisticated school who developed over many years. But the mature view of the Sarvastivadin school was something like that the past and the present and the future exist in the same sense, so they're not differentiated ontologically. Okay, but the present moment was efficacious. Okay, it has a causal energy to it, whereas the past and the future had no energy. Okay, and it didn't have energy in the same way, so it couldn't bring about any effect, couldn't cause anything. So the present moment is functional. You might translate it as functional, and which is not dissimilar from what's being said here. Okay. Something like that, yeah.
Just thinking about the retreat, I was like, it's a bit similar to when he's, the monk was saying how we act in the present moment depends on the momentum of bad habits and good habits and our response to them. So it's kind of looking at a certain habit force or pattern,
yeah,
that comes from the past and is kind of built up and has,
right,
a certain momentum.
Right.
And then the way we train ourselves to respond. And I thought that was quite nice. It just sounds a bit similar.
Yeah.
What's happened before.
Right. Yeah. And if you take the present moment only doctrine to an extreme, then you can't do that kind of thing.
No.
Yeah. And so actually, it's not as silly as it might sound.
Like wheels kind of go when you push them together.
Right. There's only one point where it contacts the ground. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Is there a difference between the philosophical abstract and higher view to create a psychological
For sure, yeah. Yeah. And the kind of the problem that we have is that what we tend to have is the books written by the philosophers. So that's basically what tends to have come down to us, especially from this period. So a lot of it, you know, it's simply the case that the material talks about it in a philosophical and abstract way. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's what everyone was doing. It just means that they were the ones who were composing the books, that's all. Yeah, and I mean that's one of the things I tried to speculate about a little bit in History of Mindfulness. Like if you actually look at those two different attitudes towards time, the attitude of seeing past, present and the future is an attitude of seeing extension in time. So it's smoother time, so it's more like a samatha mindset where you're actually seeing continuity. Whereas if you want to divide time, past, future and present up and you're only seeing the present moment, that's more like vipassana approach where you're seeing impermanence. And so it might be related to a different kind of emphasis and meditation among the schools as well. But that's just purely speculative because we don't have the specific meditation texts from that period. Okay. Alrighty. Right. Let's check okay.
What about the difference between identity view and the other identity being, say for instance, someone understands themselves to be a stream enter.
Yeah.
But then the underlying tendency to the view of self is still there, and then when the right conditions come up,
the
view comes back.
Comes back.
It's still there.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we all experience that.
Yeah.
You know, we all go through. We all go through times when there's no sensual desire.
And then
you know.
Boom.
There's these flashes or instants. I remember one or two.
Mm-hmm. Or what about Eva's attack?
And okay. Yogananda Mango. Okay. There is a path, Ananda, a way, a magga, a patibada, for the abandoning Pahanaya of the five lower fetters. That anyone, without relying on that path, on that way, shall know or see or abandon the five lower fetters, that this is not possible. Okay? Netang tanang vijati. So this is the idiom that's always used in Pali to express a definitive impossibility. Netang tanang vijati.
It's not possible to stand?
Yeah, literally, that state does not exist. Literally, time in that sense means state or that thing does not exist. Okay? Just as when there is a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, it is not possible that anyone shall cut out its heartwood without cutting through its bark and sapwood. Okay? Just as Ananda, a great tree would be standing possessed of heartwood, sara, and then without cutting through the tata, the skin, okay? And the inner wood, what are they translated as? The
sapwood,
yeah. Then, without cutting through those things, that one could cut through the heartwood, bhavisati netang tanang vidyati. So we've been doing a bit of, you didn't realise when we were doing the tree chopping the last few weeks, we're actually, it was in a secret preparation for the sutra. You can see. Okay? Now, in exactly that state does not exist. In just the same way that anyone should, there is a path, there is a way for the abandoning of the five lower fetters, that anyone should, without arriving at that path, abandon the four lower fetters, we should know or see or abandon them. No, nyasati, should they know or should they see? Netang tanang vijati. That is not possible, okay? And then of course the opposite is true, but by going to that path that should anyone should abandon it, then that is possible. Tanametang vijati. Okay? And Now, the next part, we now have, we are now in the translation to chapter, paragraph 8, or section 8 here. Now, section 8 in the Chinese is just after the next section, and it seems like the Pali has mixed up the order of the paragraphs here, because you'll notice that he talks about there is a path, there is a way, then he has the simile of the river Ganges, and then afterwards it says, and what is the path, what is the way? Yeah, on paragraph 9. So it seems that the Chinese has the correct sequence of paragraphs here, and the Pali's got the order of the paragraph mixed up.
Didn't have any change,
did you? Yeah. And so, what? So, leaving aside that simile for the moment, what, Ananda, is the path, what is the way to the abandoning of the five lower fetters? Here, with the seclusion from the acquisitions. Okay? Upadhi, from the upadhis, here is just another word for defilements. Okay? Upadhi viveka, akusalanang dhammanang, with the abandoning of unskillful dhammas, and with the tranquilization of all bodily dutulang.
What does that mean,
inertia? Well, this is, I disagree with that translation, because you do not tranquilize inertia.
Yeah.
Inertia is already inert.
Yeah.
That's why it's inertia, yeah? So I translate dutula as disturbance. Okay?
Tranquilization of bodily disturbance.
Disturbances, yeah? That's how I would translate that. Viviche vakamehi vivita kusalehi damehi, quite secluded from sensual desires, secluded from unskillful dhammas, savitakang, savicharang, with vitaka and vichara, vivekajang, one enters into the born of seclusion, the rapture and bliss born of seclusion, the first jhana, one enters and abides. Okay? So, yareva tatta hoti, so whatever there is of rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara, and vijnana, those dhammas one regards as anicca, dukkha, roga, disease, ganda, a boil, tumor, salato, a barb, as a calamity, agata, as a disease, an affliction, parato, as an alien, literally as other, palokato, as disintegrating, sunyato, as empty, anattato, as not self. Okay, and those, the mind turns away from those dhammas, and having turned the mind away from those dhammas, one directs the mind towards the deathless element. Okay, then contemplating etang santang, etang panitang, this is peaceful, this is sublime, that is to say, the samatha of all sankharas. Okay, sankhara here revealing its meaning of activities, not formations. Again, just as you cannot tranquilize inertia, similarly you cannot pacify whatever a formation. Yeah, you can tranquilize an activity. Yeah, James.
I'm glad you raised inertia again.
Mm-hmm.
Inertia is a tendency to remain in a particular state, whether it is inert or moving.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
So a body that is moving, for example, a vehicle rolling down a hill,
mm-hmm,
has inertia.
Yeah. Yeah, or does it have momentum?
No, that's inertia.
No, it's inertia.
Yeah.
Momentum is the same as inertia?
Mm-hmm. In this sense. But talking about changing the state, none of energy is changed.
Yeah,
yeah, but inertia is without changing the state. It's the,
oh,
yeah,
it's gone. I wanted to write it.
It is in support, the comment is actually in support of your change translation as to disharmony or...
Here you go. Definition.
Okay, property of matter that causes it to resist changes in speed or direction.
Yeah.
Tendency of a body at rest to remain at rest, or a body in motion to remain at motion in motion unless disturbed by an external force. Okay, yeah, quite right. Tendency of an object to at rest to remain at rest, or object to remain at rest. I suppose if NASA says that sort of means, they'd have to work it out if they've got to get those things to get to
Mars.
Yeah,
well,
that's the definition of the word. But
it supports what the point of the exercise is that definition of inertia is not a state of quietude.
Right.
Which is, you raised this as an issue, and you said a preferred translation was
disturbance.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it could well be regarded as a disturbance.
Yeah. But it might not be.
No.
Okay.
But it's something that resists change.
Something that resists change. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay, good. So again, sabba sankhara samato, the pacifying or the tranquilizing of all sankharas, activities, that means all conditioned things. Sab upadhi patinisago, abandoning of all upadhis, all stuff. Tanha kayo, the ending of craving. Kaya meaning?
Not distraction.
Thank you. Viraga, distraction, niroda, cessation, nibbana. And then, standing right there, one attains to the kaya,
the aiding
of the defilements, the asavas, or if one does not attain to the kaya of the defilements, then because of that desire, the raga for the Dhamma, and that delight in the Dhamma, then with the abandoning of the five lower fetters, one is spontaneously reborn, upapatiko hoti, tateva parinibbayi, and right there attains parinibbana without subject to return from that world. In other words, one's a non-returner. This, Ananda, is the path, this is the way for the abandoning of the five lower fetters. Okay? Now, we'll just come back. That's quite a beautiful and quite a lovely passage there. And of course, we've preceded it with that statement, the Buddha saying, netang tanang vijjati, that without following this path, that one should get that this is not possible, just like you can't cut through a tree. And so this, of course, is like, this is the Buddha being in his usual kind of ambiguous, unclear, hard to understand manner, throwing out a statement and saying, it's up to you, you can have your own opinions on it, and there are different ways of looking at it. Or not, right? So and sometimes he would do that, and sometimes he's saying, "This is it, right?" And I don't care about postmodern stuff, right? The Buddha was not hung up on Derrida, right? He said, "This is the truth, and that's it." Okay. So of course, then everybody comes along and tries to say, "Well, it doesn't really mean that." And of course, this was in the article by Bhikkhu Bodhi. And he was saying, well, yes, that seems to be fairly definitive, but, you know, maybe it's not really. And so I don't know how possibly that it could have been any more definitive. So this is one of the statements that makes it very, very clear that one is practicing jhanas before getting attainment. At least in this particular passage, it's only talking about the attainment of non-return and arahant. Doesn't mention the stream enterer and the once returner. The reason why not is, of course, because that's what's set up at the start of the sutta. The start of the sutta is asking the topic about the five lower fetters and how, and abandoning the five lower fetters. And of course, that's talking about the non-returner. Okay, so the sutta is not concerned with the stream enterer or the once returner. So we can't read anything into the absence of the stream enterer or once returner here. That simply, this is not what the topic of this sutta is. So it's a very, very emphatic and definitive statement. And as Venerable Brahmani pointed out in his essay, one, in the discussion about whether jhanas is necessary, one of the arguments which is sometimes raised is that lokiya jhanas are not necessary, but lokuttara jhanas are necessary. Okay? Now, one problem with that, of course, is that the distinction between lokiya jhanas and lokuttara jhanas is an abhidhamma distinction, it's not found in the suttas. And so Bhikkhu Bodhi, in his article, notes that, and but Brahmali says that that's not taking it far enough, because uh,
the meaning of Lokya?
Worldly. Equals worldly. Huh? Worldly. And this is beyond, literally beyond the world. Beyond the world. And interestingly enough, neither of those actually corresponds to how the Buddha himself talked about it. The Buddha himself in the sutta says that jhana is lokanta, is the end of the world. Yeah?
End of what world?
The world of the five senses.
End of every world you've ever known. Yeah? It's the end of the world in the sense that you're standing. That's it. That's it. You know, do you remember in The Gods Must Be Crazy?
Yeah.
Yeah? And he went on that whole journey to get rid of this Coke bottle. And he finally reaches that point where he's standing on the cliffs, yeah? And he's looking out and there's just the mist and so on as far as you can see. In that sense, that's what jhana is, in the end of the world, yeah? Yeah?
Throwing the ring into the fire.
Throwing the ring into the fire, yeah? Or else,
everything we've ever known is about the six senses, right?
Right.
And in this case, with jhana, you completely get rid of
five senses. Yeah.
What if you practice jhana in the previous life?
And you're not doing it in this life.
Yeah, but yeah. Unless you're
doing it
at the end of the world.
Yeah. Yeah, the sutras don't talk about that, actually. It's kind of, it's one of those little things, the sutras, you think that there would be some discussion about that, that kind of thing, but there's nothing. Yeah. So, according to the Abhidhamma, worldly equals Brahma Loka, Brahma Loku, Pratiya Samvatati. You know that? Samvatati. Brahma Loku Papatiya. So, what does that mean?
The world of Brahma. Something.
It means leading to rebirth in the Brahma realms. So this is according to the Abhidhamma. That's how they define Lokiya jhana. Okay, and so this is Nibbana. Nibbanaya would be Nibbanaya. So this is something like that is how the Abhidhamma defines the difference between the two. Lokiya jhana is leading to rebirth in the Brahma realms. Lokuttara jhana is leading to rebirth in Nibbana. Okie dokie?
Leading to rebirth in Nibbana.
Sorry. Thanks.
Wrong view there.
Okay, I've only had one small cup of coffee. All right? Leading to Nibbana. So leading to the ending of rebirth. Right? So, Just to be clear in our minds, that this distinction is an Abhidhamma distinction made in the Dhammasangani, Vibhanga, other books of the Pali Abhidhamma, not found in the suttas. Perhaps it has a basis in the suttas, so I'm not saying that it doesn't, but I'm just simply saying the terminology is there. So, just to finish off this little bit of an argument here, Bhikkhu Bodhi said, and it has been used in the past to argue that passages like this that seem to suggest, not just seem to suggest, but that definitively and categorically state that jhanas are necessary for enlightenment, are in fact talking about Lokuttara jhanas, okay, rather than Lokiya jhanas. Now, Lokuttara jhana was defined by the later Abhidhamma as being a mind moment, okay? So it's not a real jhana, actually. It's just a mind moment, okay? And so this is how they get beyond the idea of saying you need jhanas, is by saying that you've just got this mind moment that happens at the moment of enlightenment. Righty? One problem with that, as Bhikkhu Bodhi points out, is that that distinction is not made in the suttas.
Say that again.
Say it again?
Yeah. About the mind moment.
Mind moment.
Different?
Is what, sorry?
Different to why the mind moment means that you don't need jhana.
Okay. According to some... Okay, so according to the developed Abhidhamma analysis, this is not the Abhidhamma Pitaka, this is in the Visuddhimagga, said at the moment of enlightenment you experience a number of what they call mind moments, which are like a flash, like an instant, yeah? And one of those mind moments is called the Magga Citta, the mind, the path moment, okay? Magga chitta, okay? That magma moment chitta equals ega kana. Ega kana is one moment, okay? So the magga chitta is one moment. So that means that at that one moment, all eight path factors exist in the mind, yeah? And that just goes boom, and then right after that you have the palachitta, okay? Palachitta, which is about 4 or 5 mind moments, I think 3 or 4 mind moments or something like that. And that's the fruition, okay? So according to the developed Abhidhamma analysis, one mind moment is the path. And whenever the Buddha talked about the Noble Eightfold Path, he was in fact just talking about that mind moment. Right? Which of course is a bit of a weird kind of doctrine. And so because you have the jhana factors present in the mind for that one mind moment, then you don't need to actually develop jhana as a meditation practice before that. It just happens at the moment. So this is a theoretical construct which is used by the Vipassana schools to justify the excluding the meditative practice jhanas.
But everything is just a moment.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, one moment you have mother to do and one moment you don't, there has to be a difference between the moment
and the moment. Yes. Well, the idea that everything is a moment again is a late Abhidhamma idea. So whether that applies to the suttas or not is an open question. Fair enough point taken that if you're developing jhana at that moment, you have the jhana, it's only one moment, yeah? But practically speaking, when the Buddha said to develop jhanas, he meant an actual meditation practice where you're sitting.
Yeah, passive open sense of those ones, enter and abide in this.
Yeah, and you have the words like to enter and abide. Obviously, you don't abide in a mind moment. So the word viharati is pleonastic, but we don't need to go there. Okay, and so that's one point. But the other point that Venerable Brahmali makes, which is quite correct also, is that even if that distinction is entirely correct, we can't apply it in this case because it's explicitly been taught that the jhana is a precondition for developing insight. Okay? It's not an outcome of developing insight. Okay? So first of all, one gets into the jhana, practices that, and then you reflect on that as all the 5 aggregates in there are Nietzsche and so on and so forth, and that's how you get enlightenment. So clearly the jhana is being used as a basis for developing insight and not as a function of the mind of the moment of enlightenment.
So that paragraph there is one that says that?
Yeah, this paragraph here, yeah. This paragraph isn't, that's just my
opinion. Because in the other paragraph it was one of the things before.
Which paragraph? Yeah. One sees those dhammas as an Icha Dukkha, so on?
Yeah, it doesn't talk about vihara anywhere. It just goes straight on, and the object is sankhara. So you're in jhana, the object is sankhara, so it doesn't really sound like jhana.
Yeah, the next paragraph is talking about vipassana, yeah?
But that's following.
But this is following, yeah? So first of all, one gets into jhana. That raises another question, which is also a bit of a slightly controversial question, is whether you actually do the insight inside the jhana or not. Most people say that you need to emerge from the jhana to do insight. So there are sort of passages that kind of suggest both things. This particular passage is ambiguous. This merely says that you reflect on the dhammas that were within the jhana. It doesn't tell you whether you reflect on them at the same time or you reflect on them subsequently. Okay, so it's not actually doesn't help us in that particular case. Okay? So first of all, practice, abandon the defilements, get into jhana, then reflect on the factors of that jhana as anicca, dukkha, and all the other things. And then the mind turns away from those things. So it turns away from sankharas as being suffering and turns towards the deathless as being peaceful. And then this is, by that means, attains to either anagami or arahant.
And this is specifically talking about the non-returner.
Yes.
Not someone who's just the Joe Blow who comes along and says, well, you get attached to these things and die anyway, so what's the point? Mm-hmm. This is actually a person who's gone way along the path and has come to like
yeah.
the end of the path, and then
yeah.
or the last thing that they're getting attached to is deep meditation states.
Right.
Yeah.
Is this Sankara Samadhi?
Yeah. No. Sankara Samatha is not a. That's just a word for Nibbana. Yeah. Sankara here Samatha is a word for Nibbana. It's the pacification of all sankaras. Yeah. This is a standard list of synonyms of Nibbana. So again, very powerful and quite a beautiful passage. And of course, that's repeated for the other four jhanas. And just before going on to finish that off, we'll just come back to this. We skipped over the simile of the Ganges, because as I said, the Chinese puts that later, which is more... seems a bit more plausible in that case. Supposing under the river Ganges, Ganga, Nadi, was full, pura, udakasa, of water. Samatitika, up to the brim. Just like we have our Sekhya rule, Samatitika and Tindapata and Bunji Samiti. And we eat food with the food up to the brim. Kakapeyo, so that a crow might drink from it. Okay? Kaka is a crow. Okay, so then a feeble man, dubalako, dubala, strength, dub, weak, dubala, come across thinking, by swimming across the river with my arms, I shall get safely across the further shore of this river Ganges, and he would be able. Oh, sorry, hang on, I'll skip my paragraphs here. Oops, then he would not be able, thought there was something wrong there, to get safely across. So too, when the Dhamma is being taught to someone for the cessation of personality, oh dear.
Because the Buddha just before refuted the whole idea about or having the idea of a person.
Yeah.
And in relation to the five law fetters, and now we have destruction of personality. How can you destruct a personality when one doesn't exist in the first place?
That's one problem. Just to come up to the other problem is it says personality instead of identity.
So it's a
translation problem, yeah. He hasn't translated it consistently.
They probably changed his
translation, yeah. So, but in this case, Sakaya Nirodha, so it's just an idiom meaning for Sakaya Ditti. Yeah.
Desiyamane,
Desiyamane, yes. When Dhamma is being taught, Desiyamane, present participle. So too, when the Dhamma is being taught for someone for the cessation of identity, if his mind does not enter into it and acquire confidence, steadiness, and resolution, then he can be regarded as like the feeble man. Okay, now that's a very interesting little pointette, isn't it? Yeah, you kind of when you hear the Dhamma, and it does your mind actually leap up to that? Do you say, yeah, right? And do you have that enthusiasm and that strength? And so, if you don't have that enthusiasm, that love of Dhamma, then it's not possible to abandon those things.
He doesn't say, oh, well, I just didn't teach it well enough, did he?
No. He wasn't such
a
Buddha. Not
a very good teacher.
Low self-esteem wasn't a big issue for the Buddha.
Not about self-esteem, yeah. Skill.
So, and then of course the opposite applies. If there was a strong man, a Bhava Puriso, of course, we have to.
But if you have,
mm-hmm. So we're just helping the suttas along here. Okay. So I'll just leave that like that. Okay. So then a strong man or woman should come along and say, I'm going to cross this. No. There's no strong man.
Susie Moroney.
She like swam around so many places. And
what?
A swimmer. Female swimmer. Susie Moroney. No relation to Susie Quattro, huh?
She swam really good. She swam like.
Yeah.
The
whole. Yeah. Okay.
So. A strong woman just loves the fact that she's
So, by swimming across this river with my arms, I shall get safely across to the further shore of this river Ganges, and he would be able to get safely across. So too, when the Dharma is being taught to someone for the cessation of identity, if his mind enters into it and acquires confidence, steadiness, and resolution, then he can be regarded as like the strong person. Alrighty? So again, that's quite a nice little simile there. And just to return then back to the proceeding along the process of developing insight, we've done four jhanas, and then sabbaso rupa sanyanang samatikkama patgha sanyanang athangmananata sanyanang manasikara ananto akasoti akasanchanya yatanang upasampanja viharati. Okay? With surmounting of all perceptions of rupa, here meaning
the rupa that is seen in meditation.
Rupa, yeah, probably meaning the samadhi nimitta. Huh? So not perceiving a samadhi nimitta anymore, getting rid of all patigha sanyana, perceptions of resistance or limitation, and having not paying attention to perceptions of diversity. And then with the idea, literally it doesn't mean thinking, of course, but ananto akaso, space is infinite. And then just abides in the basic infinite space. So, whatever there is of rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana. Hang on. Why is rupa here? Aren't we in the formless jhanas? Are there any feeling? Yeah, but it says whatever tatta, whatever therein, since referring back to the jhana there, whatever rupa gatang, vedana gatang, sanya gatang. Anyway, Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation doesn't have rupa, and nor does he have a note on it. So presumably his reading, whatever manuscript he was using, didn't have rupa there.
Usually he uses the term meaning still.
He does, but in this case it doesn't
this
have a note.
This is the Sinhala, so.
This is the Sinhala. Yeah, it looks probably just a transmission error. Obviously, it would be very easy for that to creep in there.
Yes, because it's just repetitive I and
okay, so just a slight difference with the Chinese version that long kind of passage on insight there is shorter in the Chinese. The Chinese is just says contemplating rise and fall. Okay, so you're just contemplating impermanence. So that long passage of seeing anicca, dukkha, and as a disease, a barb, a calamity, and so on, is not found in the Chinese in that particular case. Nor is it found about turning the mind away from that experience and directing it to the deathless element. Okay, the Chinese has comparable treatment only in relation to the last attainment in the series, the attainment of nothingness. Okay. So in other words, the insight passage is more simple in the Chinese. Okay, that's not necessarily particularly meaningful. That's just a redaction choice. The Chinese in other places does have similar passages. It seems that the Chinese doesn't.
That the Pali one.
The Pali does in for everyone, yeah.
Something that you can just get first time
in the power of first time line, just kind of get first time. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that will be hinted at later in the sutta. Mm.
The thing rise and fall, because the word impermanence, I understand to be something that's there, you know, is no longer there, impermanent.
Yep.
But what words do they use to describe impermanence? In the sutta? You had impermanence, and you had some words,
oops.
But in Pali or the Chinese, what words did they use to describe
impermanence?
I can hear
impermanence
again.
Impermanence is anicca to. Okay. So as impermanent, as anicca. Okay. The Chinese has. This.
Can't see.
Yeah, yeah.
Can't
see.
On the bottom you have your, in terms of impermanence, absence of impermanence.
That's a
very
easy reason. There,
when it comes in. 400. On the bottom, I need.
There we go.
No, but could you make it smaller, please?
Yeah, I want to try to figure that Chinese.
Maybe the file's corrupt.
Yeah, I think.
Doesn't look right, does it?
It doesn't look like any great. See right there, could you zoom?
Yeah, this is Xin here. It's obviously corrupt. For some reason, this is the PDF's corrupted.
Yeah. There's an absence of desire and some other words. Okay,
yep.
Absence of desire, eradication, and abandoning.
Yep.
All that description of impermanence?
No, this is... Okay, so normally it just has rise and fall, so presumably they're the characters for rise and fall. Then for the last attainment in the series, the attainment of nothingness, the Chinese version depicts, however, a more detailed development of insight. This treatment begins by speaking of pleasant, painful, and neutral feeling. Since with the attainment of the sphere of nothingness, pleasant and painful feelings have long been left behind in the fourth jhana, the instruction given here could be intended as a general statement applicable to all previously mentioned jhana experiences. Okay? So what he's suggesting is that there's a more detailed treatment of insight in the Chinese only right at the end, but that the nature of that suggests that actually originally it was meant to apply for all of them. Again, maybe just a redactor's choice. The development of insight described at this point instructs to contemplate feelings in terms of impermanence, rise and fall, absence of desire, that would be viraga, cessation, nirodha, eradicating and abandoning. Okay? And so these are the corrupt Chinese characters.
So rise and fall is different than impermanence. I don't know what rise and fall is. Like, what is this rise and fall?
Yeah, no, it's usually basically the same as impermanence. It's just a synonym. And in lists like that, they commonly have lists, those synonyms included in there. Not necessarily different. So rise and fall basically is the same as impermanence.
It's like cessation? I guess, because, you know, from... I guess we could understand that... to clarify my understanding of impermanence,
yep.
Something that's there and is no longer there, what is meant by impermanence.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Then I guess you can listen to Andrew's book.
Yeah. But it's the same thing as like in the famous verse Anicca vata sankhara upadavaya dhammino, alas, sankharas are impermanent, subject to rise and fall, or of the nature to rise and fall. Okay, so it's basically the same thing. So the impermanence of them is the fact that their nature is to rise and fall.
Having arisen, they cease.
Yeah.
Cease.
Because that's a nicer word, because fall is, I get confused. Cease.
Cessation, yeah, cessation. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Could you just close that second word, other things?
Absence of desire, viraga, cessation, nirodha, eradicating.
What does that mean, eradicating?
Oh, it's probably pahana or something like that. Getting rid of, abandoning. But again, these two are just synonyms.
Okay, so
Vairagya
means
getting rid of defilements.
So would it be good that after each meditation, we, like, no, when we meditate, and after at the end of our meditation, we sort of just go over our meditation and feel how peaceful we are.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be good then to at the end of each meditation and when we feel peaceful, contemplate, okay, I'm peaceful because I have no more desire, things have ceased and eradicated.
Yeah.
So it would be good to go over all these after?
Yeah, that's nice.
Eradicate? Could you explain what eradicate means?
It's getting rid of.
Very strong.
Yeah, I mean, whether that's the implication of the Chinese is hard to say, but eradicating, exterminating.
Exterminator.
Abandoned.
It has a far more aggressive edge than abandoning.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a word that Anala has chosen to render a Chinese term, which the Chinese translator chose to render.
Of course, have a Sanskrit.
Yeah, so what it actually means, it's hard to say. Alright. So that's all good. So, and then up to the vijnana jayatanam and the from the basic infinite space, infinite consciousness to thinking there's nothing at all. One enters and abides in the base of nothingness. Okay. Oh, here we go. Yadeva tatta hoti vedanagatang sanyagatang. So it doesn't have rupa here. And up here, does it have rupa? There we go. Oh, here it has rupa. So the first two forms of tamas has got rupa, presumably by mistake. But the last one has got the correct reading, vedanagatang. Okay. And it doesn't have the final formless attainment. Neva sanya na sanya. Why is that? It's just simply because Malumpiputta was so sick of hearing neither this nor that that he decided not to create a version in him by talking about it more? Or was there something deeper?
That's the non-perception or non-perception.
Neither perception nor non-perception. So this is the only attainment that's missed out. So one doesn't...
Why have to look at the
Chinese
too? We have to...
Chinese is the same.
Okay. Well, if you say, well, if you reflect back on the different factors that have disappeared, so the roof is not there, the redness is not there, but the sanya is to kind of be confused because it's neither there nor not there.
Uh-huh.
So then how do you render that? Then you have to go for a whole different spiel about what is that and how is that and how do you understand that. You know what I mean? You can't say it's there nor
Namin.
It's not there.
Namin.
Namin.
I know what you mean,
yeah.
It's something, I think something like that, yeah. According to the commentary, the neither perception nor non-perception is too subtle to serve usefully as a basis for insight. There's probably somewhere where it says Buddhas and chief disciples or something like that can attain insight based on it. Yeah, but there is this thing, and it does appear a few places. I think there's another note here Bhikkhu Bodhi refers to, 5.4. 5.4, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, just says it's too subtle.
That would be interesting
if there
was new word of sanatha picked up. Yeah. Because that's the cessation.
Yeah.
Tanya. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It was both a matter of perception, disappearing on the table. I remember Ajahn Brahman's having this describing it, is that from one end, there's no object of perception, but then you're perceiving that there's no object. So from one end, there's no perception, neither perception, but you're perceiving that there's no perception. And
Is that a useful addition to the discussion about matter possession?
I don't know.
We're talking about it like, because before when we were talking about that, it was something like it's something vague in between. But that seems like a good understanding of it.
Thank you.
Why is it in the other sutras, like the Chula Sanyasa, that they would go to that one and then
Well, is that
the only school?
Yeah, there's that. There's another sequence that we call the nine attainments, the four form attainments, formless attainments, and Nirodha Samapatti, and then get enlightened. That's a pure Samatha school, yeah. The dry Samatha school. the difference at this kind of level of meditation attainments, I'm not sure how useful it is to clarify these things, but it seems that what's happening there is something like that. You continue, you got the neither perception nor non-perception, and then that ends, so you don't even have that, and then you call that cessation. And they said, cool.
The ocean, like the Dharma's very deep, and you have to, you go gradually down into it, and it gets deeper and deeper like the ocean.
Yeah.
So that's all this discernment that goes on in the, after the first jhana, after the second jhana.
Yeah.
I said, well, I just want to climb up and jump up, you know. I just said, well, you're just splashing around in the ocean, shallow, so, yeah. Do you understand? We have to have done all that deferment before you jump off the cliff.
Right.
You just end up in breaking your neck and smashing
it. Yeah. It said, according to the...
Yeah, it is, of course. I wasn't very funny with it.
According to the commentaries, they say, and I think there's some reason to this, that the attainment of cessation is like when you have the unified power of samatha and vipassana together. And then when they're together in that in complete strength, then they create that state or enable the mind to enter that state. So, Either way is fine, really. Yeah.
Well, that's what she said.
It's fine. It seems to me like a slightly different way of developing insight that the way it's talking about here is, you get the state and then you develop insight on that state, whereas the way of attaining cessation is like you continue going down that same road, and it just happens at the end of that same path. Anyway. Okay. Ananda's last question. If, Bhante, there is a path, if there's a practice for the abandoning of the five lower fetters, then why here are there some bhikkhus called Cheto Vimuti and some bhikkhus called Panya Vimuti?
Which paragraph?
16. Okay. So here referring to two different kinds of arahant. Now, when the Buddha talked about arahantship, usually, in the vast majority of cases, he would say Cheto Vimuti, Panya Vimuti, and they'd be synonyms. They're both talking about the arahant. So all arahants have Cheto Vimuti, is release of heart, and all arahants have Panya Vimuti, released by wisdom. Okay? And obviously, in some sense, the basic meaning of these is the Cheto Vimuti is, the emotional release, which is gained through doing samatha meditation. Panya Vimuti is the cognitive or wisdom release based on doing vipassana meditation. Okay? And all arahants have both of those. That's not in question. Now, in a few cases apart from that, because they're distinguished some are called Cheto Vimutti, some called Panya Vimutti, and some called Ubhato Bhaga Vimutti, which means two sides. Yeah, Ubhato Bhaga. Okay, so and that means both. So and the basic meaning of these things is not problematic. Basically, it means that some bhikkhus will emphasize samatha more, some will emphasize vipassana more, and some of them will develop both of them to an equal degree. Okay, Subhuto Bhaga Vimutti. That's basically what it means. And so the Buddha replies, here I say that there is a distinction in the faculties. So here the indriya, the spiritual faculties. And so basically meaning that some will have stronger samadhi and some will have stronger wisdom. It does not entirely clear there, but it seems pretty much that that's what the meaning is. So this kind of distinction on the Cheta Vimutti, Panya Vimutti has become, I think, the locus of a number of entirely unnecessary discussions and so on. That modern academics try to argue that Panya Vimutti means getting enlightened by going to their courses and discussing the philosophy of Dhamma in a university. Not quite, but something like that, which is obviously not what it means. And of course, the Vipassana schools try to argue that certain kinds of Panya Vimutti, Arahant, do not have jhanas, which of course elsewhere, the Panya Vimutti elsewhere is defined specifically as somebody who gets into first jhana and then contemplates it with the wisdom. Okay, so it certainly doesn't mean that they don't get jhana, and it's obviously in the context of this particular sutta it's saying that you have to have jhana, so that's not a question. So this is the Mahamalunkiputta Sutta. So, just to come back to and just to remind us of the main passage in here, which I think is very, very beautiful, talking about the abandoning of all the defilements and all the stuff in the mind, all the crap and the rubbish, getting rid of that so that you can find peace of mind. And then the mind goes into a place of stillness and joy, the joy and rapture of that in that state of jhana. Yeah? And then seeing that with the eye of wisdom and using that to develop insight. This is the path. Yeah? And you see, even that mind of peace and bliss and mind is impermanent. Even that is suffering. Even that is a disease, a boil, an affliction, a dart, and so on. And then developing, using that for developing deep insight and turning away from sankharas to the deathless. Yeah? I think I find this is very, very beautiful. Anyone got any more questions?
So in this indriya thing, different indriyas, do you really think that it means the indriyas as in the Bodhipratidharma indriyas?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah? Yeah. Does this mean faculties? Because if you just translate faculties, you could say, oh, my faculties are generally good today.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that evil wanting to translate one term with one term equals one translation?
Yeah,
that's
not evil.
Is that what it is?
Not evil, good.
You know what I mean.
I know what you mean. Yes. Yeah. Spiritual faculties.
Not just turning voluntary. Jhanas. The first path training. What offers within the attribute? My understanding is that for those people who have managed to make their way to cessation, even though they may not be aware of it for quite some time, but after that, they can operate from outside of the evidence with detachment. That's just an interesting point that I find that work.
What do you mean outside the aggregates?
The capacity to have detachment from to know the aggregate, the rupa, process the time station, mental formation, feeling, body, from a detached point of view. But there's no one actually doing the detachment, it's just a detached point of view.
And
one operates and works from that point to uproot, or whatever the case may be, the unsubtle, the defilements. I have read some commentaries by certain thinkers who made these statements. I just find it a very interesting observation. In respect to some of sorry, the other this sutta, it gives rise to certain insights after how one is treating the subject matter.
Yeah, there's certainly that kind of, in this way it's presenting, there's certain that kind of degree of objectivity, to be able to sort of stand back and sort of reflect about the nature of the aggregates and these kinds of things.
Yeah, and it's the sort of Venerable Sariputra, where he describes bringing the activities of sense consciousness, perception, mental formation, change of body, to the shore of knowing, where there is a knowing that knows that, knows the kanda, and all experience pertaining kind of are brought to the shore where the waves can no longer. Well, it's a detached point of view, a type of consciousness which is detached from the aggregate and the corresponding sense objects. And that particular sutta, he describes bringing understanding. Or bringing these things to shore of understanding where they can pass no more. And from that point of view or point of knowing, the work is done.
That's quite beautiful, isn't it? Okay. Any more questions, comments, anything? Al's got a little note there. Bhante, crap in the mind. Is it really all crap? Getting rid of all the crap in the mind. Is it really all crap? The veins, the veins, the thoughts are being experienced. We are having something experiencing, something feelings we are having is where we are right now. I guess we have to, I guess it's many thousand dollars or critical of our thoughts and experiences and feelings. Like upadi, when we say stuff, is actually a word for defilements, really. So in that sense, but upadi kind of crosses over with the internal attachment to the defilements, but also the things which we get onto it, we gather to ourselves because of that. It's not necessarily to say that all feelings, thoughts, experiences and so on are wrong, but it's to say that getting rid of our attachment and so on to those things. It's interesting. I mean, it's used, the classical context of that is where the Buddha sort of approaches a farmer and he says to the farmer, how are you going? And he says, I'm fine, I'm happy because I've got all my upadis. See, I've got my cows, I've got my house, I've got my ranch, I've got my family, I've got my sons. And so on, these are all my upadis, therefore I'm happy and secure. And the Buddha says, oh, I've got rid of my house, I've got rid of my farm, I've got rid of my family, I've got rid of my cows. That's why I don't have any nirupadis. I'm nirupadi, don't have any upadis, that's why I'm secure. And there was a crash of thunder and lightning, just like there was this afternoon. I was in my Kutu reading this afternoon. I thought it was just outside my cliff. I was unbelievable. I was like,
the whole front was covered in
hail, yeah?
Yeah, white, completely white.
Yeah, amazing.
That's that thundering. That's
such a thunder. Yeah, it's the thundering, yeah. That was thundering. Okay. So let's finish by next witness.
Sāpipanno bhagavato sāpipanno